Okay, let's open with a word of prayer on this. Father, I just thank you so much for all that you've done for us. We thank you for this reading. We thank you for all the wonderful gifts that you've given to us through your Torah portion today. I ask that all the words that come out would be your words and not my own. In Yeshua's name, amen. Okay, so I titled this, that Yahweh keeps his promises. It's important for us to know that death isn't the end of the promises. Just because we die doesn't mean his promises are finished. If that was the case, we would be all doomed. In Genesis 23, starting with the verse 1, we have Sarah's death. She died at 127. Well, that in itself doesn't mean a whole lot to us, but she is the only one in the whole scriptures that her death was mentioned as far as her age was. In those days, they didn't mention the women's death, and they barely mentioned that they even were born. So we have to come with, away with this idea that they were also daughters born to these people as well as sons. Traditionally speaking, from this culture, even where we're living at today in Jordan, the boys are listed in their family's heritage more than the daughters are. Now, if the father and mother only had daughters, then the privilege of the firstborn would go to the daughter. It's much the same way in the Hebrew community in those days. So she was honored in her death by the stating of her age. Abraham mourned for her because he loved her so much, and she was with him in all the different troubles and trials that they went through from the time they left Ur all the way to the time that Isaac was being taken to the time that Yahweh wanted Abraham to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. Well, we know the end of that story was that he substituted Isaac with the ram. And Sarah died shortly after that. According to Jasher, she was tricked by Hasatan, thinking that he was going to kill him, that Abraham was going to kill him. That was the whole purpose of him going away. And she was mourning for the fact of her son, and she was going out, finding out where they went and everything like that to find her son. Well, then the enemy came again and said, oh, I was mistaken. He is alive. And she had so much joy at that moment, her soul leaped out of her, according to Jasher. Abraham, at this point, after her death, requested of the sons of Heath for a burial place. And he did it in such a fashion. This is typical Middle Eastern way of doing things. You ask for something, then you bargain on the price going back and forth, and you kind of haggle a little bit. Well, he didn't want to haggle. He said, I'll pay the full price. I don't care what it is. And then they were being so-called, looked like they were being gracious. But really what they were doing is saying, if we provide a burial place for his dead, we have some control here. We can tell him to go take a hike and we'll keep all his possessions. But in reality, Yahweh wanted him to have the field and the cave in Mikron. So he requested the place from the sons of Heath, and Abraham bargaining for the burial place for his dead. Ephron gives a price. At first he was going to be gracious, it sounded like then he wanted to give him the cave. So go ahead and take it, I'll let you do that. But again, Abraham says, no, I want you to give me the full price, and I'll pay it whatever it is. So in this back and forth deal, he arrived at 400 shekels of silver, and Abraham was measured it out in front of everybody. This is very important in how this is all mentioned. He says his burial case, the burial place for Sarah was the cave of Michpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, which is near Mamre. This was mentioned in this way. It was a title deed. Everywhere else you see where he traveled to, it wasn't listed this way. But this is important because later on, when Jacob dies, and according to Jasher, it says that they had to go back to Egypt to get the title deed for this field because there was a disagreement between the sons of Esau and Jacob, his sons. They were arguing about who had the right to this place since they left and went into Egypt. So, and then you see them coming back with the title deed. The battle has already taken place. They won the day, and they were able to bury Jacob there in the same place. This title deed is still valid today because it's mentioned in the scriptures, mentioned in the Torah. In Genesis 24, after all this is done, Abraham says, okay, I'm getting old. I don't know when I'm going to die, but I want you, he's talking to his senior servant who's in charge of all his possessions. And in some places it says it's Eliezer. But it's uncertain because it doesn't really name a name here, but it's suspected it was Eliezer. I don't know about that. He seemed to be pretty old even by that estimation. So it could have been Eliezer, it could have been somebody else. But he said he wanted him to swear an oath that he would not get a bride for Isaac from the people of Canaan, where he was living at. Why? What was wrong with their women? Well, they were practicing idolatry. They were practicing divination. They were practicing all these things that Yahweh was in disagreement with. They were in disagreement with. So here we go. He wanted to get a bride from his own people back where he came from, back to Mesopotamia. So he took him and he said, okay, I want you to swear an oath. So he said, put your hand under my thigh. Well, that doesn't make any sense to us in our modern way of thinking. Why put your hand under somebody's thigh? That doesn't make any sense. Well, in those days, this also meant it's the place of where the seed of the generations were coming from. And they were swearing an oath saying that if I don't fulfill this oath, may the curse be on my children or on me if I didn't have any children, that I would die without any children. Today we have contracts. We have some sort of covenants with land deals. We have some sort of covenants when you're talking about marriages. But it's not the same idea as it is back then. This is done over and over again throughout history. Up until the modern ages. So the servant agrees. It says, but I won't agree unless there's an out. What if the woman doesn't want to come back with me? Can I bring your son over to where your family is at? He says, no, by no means will you bring my son out of this land where Yahweh has promised us and our descendants that they will inherit the land. So he says, well, what if she doesn't want to come with me? See, he finds a woman. What if she doesn't want to come with me? Well, if she doesn't want to come with you, and this is the one that Yahweh wants Isaac to have, then you're released from this agreement. And Abraham says, okay, I'll do that. If she does not want to come back with you, then you're released from this covenant, this oath. So he agrees. Then he goes on to back to Mesopotamia, and he prays. And when he gets to the well, the watering place, it's not like we would think of as a well. It's a hole in the earth. There was water in there. It could have been a cistern. It could have been a natural spring. It's unknown at this point as to what it really was. But it was dug out. We do know that by historians. And the way they would have got the water was they would have dipped into it, put it on their shoulders. The women would do this. Part of their daily task. And he prayed that if a woman comes out and I ask her for a drink, she will voluntarily say, okay, I'll give you a drink and I'll water your camels. A camel takes a lot of water to drink. If you've ever seen a camel, they're a rather large creature. And yet, I'm reminded of this idea that Yeshua said, I am the water. Come and drink from me. Living water. Because he said that to the woman at the well in Samaria. Not in Samaria. Yeah. So the Samaritans, they understood this as well, that he said this to her, that if you knew who you're asking this of, you would ask of him to give you water so you wouldn't have to thirst again. So he prays this, that she would voluntarily want to water his camels as well. And then he says, thank you, Father. Thank you, Yahweh. because you delivered her to me this day." And he was so great, so joyful, he gave her a nose ring and two bracelets. The nose ring weighed 2 ounces. That's a lot of weight for anybody's nose. But so, and I looked that up. The bracelets were pretty large as well. This shows the wealth and the generosity of Abraham. Eliezer, or whoever the servant is, was in charge of all his goods. So he was able to get the best that Abraham had on 10 different camels and his servants that went with him to help him with these camels. So also he asked that she would, if their father's house was big enough for the camels, the feed, the fodder, the feed, and also a place for them to lay down at and sleep, and his men would have food and lodging as well. And his place was big enough for sure. Well, we're introduced to somebody else that later on would come more apparent who this person is. His name is Laban. I thought that was kind of interesting. Laban means white. And that's where we get that word from. So Laban had an evil eye toward Abraham's goods. Because when Jacob went back, he was thinking that, oh, this is Abraham's descendant. He must be wealthy too. Well, I'll let him stay here for a while, and then we'll see what happens. Well, then he got that, trying to trick him in different things, change his wages several times. We'll get to that later on. So, in some places, it says that Rebecca, who's this girl, was only 10 years old, but Jasher records that, but I kind of doubt it, because it says that at one point that Rebecca was 20 years younger than Isaac, and at this point Isaac was 40 years old, so I would say that she was probably about 20 something when she went to him. So just because things don't look like it's going to work out and you're in a place that's dry and desolate, it doesn't mean that God's done with you. It means you're probably in a waiting pattern to see what you will do. If you notice that all through this, Isaac really isn't brought up that much. Isaac has been waiting for the servant to return, because I'm pretty sure at this point that Abraham has told him where his servant went and what he was doing. So he was probably preparing his mother's place for such a bride to come. He had faith that she would be there. And this is the same thing. We're at this day and age now that we're waiting for the return of our Messiah. And how long have we been waiting? Are we going to be waiting until the very end? Because he said that how many would he find when he returns? And the idea and the implication when he says this is that not many will be found. Because they'll be thinking that, well, he delays so long, let's just go on with our daily lives as if he's not going to come. And we'll live the way we want to live. Why be bound by the Torah? Why be bound by all these things? When we, in fact, should be waiting and praying and seeking his face, just as Abraham did, waiting on him. If you notice that during this whole time, there's not a lot of the dialogue between him and God at this point. All the major promises that he gave Abraham, he had saw fulfilled. That he had a son, birthed by Sarah. That he had wealth and riches, and he had prominence in the place where he was at. When you're faithful to God, he will elevate you over and over again to places of leadership, places of maybe not wealth and material wise, but like Solomon, he was given wisdom. Of course, you saw what his wisdom, he didn't use it very well a lot of places. But he was very wise. But he was also faithful to that point. And he knew, trusted God, and God gave him even more than that. What are you willing to, what are you willing to wait for him? Are you willing to trust him until the time of his coming? He said that there are those who say, well, my master delays, so I'm going to treat the servants, my fellow servants, cruel and torture them and beat them and abuse them. What will the king do then? Well, when he does come, he sees this stuff going on, he's going to hold you accountable for that. Or are you willing to wait in humility and humbleness and to help your fellow man when you see the need arise? Are you going to be doing that? Are you going to be waiting in season and out of season in prayer and fasting and seeking his face? Are you doing what he says to do now? I hope so, because we're trying to do the best we can with what we have today. And if we're not doing what he says to do now, what makes us think that we're going to do it then when he does come? In this last section, we talked about Abraham's remarriage after Sarah's death. Now, it's not certain as to when this happened, but we know it was sometime after Sarah's passing that he married Keturah. And he had 6 children by her and 10 grandchildren. And he was 175 years old when he died. And it's like, today's standard, that's a very long time. That's 100 years more than what most people live today. In fact, with the advent of GMO products and the pollution in the ground and the air and the water, I'm surprised we could even make it to 60, 65, or 70. But yet, Yahweh is good and faithful in his promises. He will protect us. He will, those who stay faithful to him, he will guide us. He will lead us. He will be our rear guard. He'll be among us if we just obey his word. If we're not going to obey his word, then all of this is pointless. It was Isaac and Ishmael who buried him in the same cave, in the same field where Sarah was born, buried. It was this field that Abraham had purchased from the sons of Heath, from Ephron. And Abraham was buried there with Sarah, his wife. This is kind of a short Torah portion, but there's so much information here. So many things that hasn't been said that need to be said. One of the things I learned out of this was even in the passing of my wife, that I found that Yahweh is always faithful to those who follow him. He always takes care of us. He always watches over us. He protects us. He's there with us whether we see him or not. He's there reassuring us along the way. He's holding our hand, and sometimes he's even carrying us. He's carrying us to the point that when we can't walk anymore, he lifts us up. And he provides for us. He shelters us. He protects us. He watches over our soul. He is our watchman, our guard. If we are just faithful to him, he will bring us home. And he will make sure that the promises he gives us is going to see its fulfillment, either in our lifetime or the lifetime of our children. But he's not forgotten us. That's the thing I remember the most. He's never forgotten us, even though we forget him. You consider all the times that Israel strayed away from God, and how many times that they thumbed their noses at him saying, there's no God. Why should we bother with this stuff? Let's make our own rules. Let's go our own ways. And yet, he's compassionate and forgiving for those who love him. And he holds us accountable when we hate him and turn away from us, from him. Then he says he's going to turn away from us. I don't know about you, but I'd rather be on his side than my own, walking away from him. That's all I have today.